Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's State House conservatives are lining up to pass high-profile gun bills. Proposals ranging from guns on campus to guns in plain sight are back.
I call this Crime Prevention 101 bill, because any law enforcement worth their grain of salt knows that criminals pick soft targets.
Also tonight, while others say it's needed, a bill making changes to Florida's Stand Your Ground law is drawing the ire of some.
For my son's murder, the jury could not agree on a verdict after being instructed on Florida's Stand Your Ground law, which encourages citizens to shoot first and ask questions later.
We'll also get the latest in the blood feud between a Tallahassee University president and the school's board of trustees, and learn about a needle exchange program for the many Florida patients who once relied on prescription painkillers but were forced instead to obtain street drugs. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. High-profile gun bills fizzled last year, but sponsors didn't keep their powder dry for long. A proposal to let guns on campus is back, and a new one to let people carry their handguns in plain sight is locked and loaded for the 2016 session, as we hear from Jim Ash.
In Florida, the open carry debate rests almost entirely on public perception. Bradford Sheriff Gordon Smith likes the message it sends to the bad guy.
I call this Crime Prevention 101 bill, because any law enforcement worth their grain of salt knows that criminals pick soft targets, easy targets, to rob, rape, and pilfer.
But Sean Bartlett, a retired grandmother who lives near Disney World, hates the message it sends to tourists, especially ones from overseas.
What does that say about Florida? We're sunshine, we're beaches, we're beautiful.
In Tallahassee, where pressure to vote for the bill is intense, no image is scarier than law enforcement and business lobbyists lined up to speak against it. And that picture got even darker Friday. In an interview, Pinellas Sheriff Bob Galtieri, legislative chair for the Florida Sheriff's Association, discussed the results of last week's internal poll. Of the state's 67 sheriffs, 47 voted against it.
There were two thoughts on the reasons why people voted against it. Some, again, conceptually, philosophically, and some more substantively as to the bill.
To Galtieri, the details of the bill are troubling. First, it mandates strict scrutiny. That means judges must strike down future laws that regulate guns in anything but the least restrictive manner. Galtieri says it could open a huge can of worms when a challenge gets to court.
So it really calls into question whether all of the current scheme of having to produce identification or where you can or can't be would even be upheld in future court challenges. So it's a very broad bill that has the potential to make some sweeping changes.
Critics are worried the least restrictive means also means no restrictions. Galtieri says sheriffs at least want the guns in holsters. Handguns stuffed into waistbands are too easy and too tempting to snatch, he says. Open carry advocates argue Florida is only one of three states that ban it, but Galtieri calls that misleading. The Texas open carry law doesn't go into effect until next year, he says. Nobody knows how well that experiment will go. Pennsylvania does allow open carry, he says, but the city of Philadelphia makes it all but impossible.
Pennsylvania technically is open carry, but you don't see open carry in Philadelphia. There's a big difference between open carry in the Pocono Mountains going down a trail than there is in downtown Philadelphia.
Critics may be influential, but so is the sponsor. Republican Senator Don Gates of Niceville is a former Senate president. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
The mother of slain teen Jordan Davis is speaking out against the gun-related bills moving through the legislature, especially one relating to Florida's controversial Stand Your Ground law. We get that story from Sasha Cordner.
Whether it's a bill allowing for open carry or another allowing for guns on college campuses, Lucia McBath says these bills are dangerous.
They're continuing to loosen and expand the use of guns in this country with no immunity. I mean, the shooters are given, you know, the immunity to be able to do whatever they want with their guns. Our communities are at risk. Our families are at risk. Our future generations are at risk. And we have to begin making our legislators accountable for what's happening in the country.
McBath is the mother of Jordan Davis, a Jacksonville teenager killed in a dispute over loud music. Michael Dunn, the man who fired the fatal shot, says it was self-defense. McBath says neither her son nor his friends were armed.
No guns, no alcohol, no drugs. The boys were completely innocent. They were shopping at the mall and simply had stopped at the gas station to get chewing gum because my son said, if we're going to pick up girls, your breath stinks, guys. We got to get chewing gum. They were simply sitting in the gas station when Michael Dunn drives in, and because they wouldn't turn their music down, he ensues an altercation with them, and he shoots 10 rounds into the car just because he could, just because the Stand Your Ground law and this state allowed it.
That's why McBath is against a bill making changes to Florida's Stand Your Ground law's immunity hearing process. Today, if a person makes a self-defense claim, they must go before a judge and prove their claim is justified to avoid a trial. But a bill moving in the legislature would now shift the burden to prosecutors. McBath says she considers this an expansion of Stand Your Ground.
Simply because now the state has the burden of proof of proving twice the guilt of the shooter. Once before, you know, a judge, and then again before a jury. And I understand having had to go through two jury trials and how disheartening and how hard it was for us to get innocence for our, I mean, you know, the innocence proven of our son and the boys. This adds an additional burden on the state to prove the innocence of the victims and the guilt of the shooter.
The bill actually stems from the case of an Indiana man who claims he was defending himself and his family from another driver who sideswiped his car and later threatened his family. While no shots were fired, Jared Bretherick pointed a gun at the other driver. His attorney, Eric Friday, who also represents gun rights group Ford to Carry, says he was charged with aggravated assault. The matter later went before the Florida Supreme Court.
Earlier this year, the Florida Supreme Court decided that a young man named Jared Bretherick, who had no criminal record, should be required to prove that he had acted in self-defense. This young man was defending his parents, both disabled veterans, and his minor sister. They were attacked by a convicted felon who had previously beaten his pregnant girlfriend, had previously beaten another driver in an almost identical road rage case, and has since then beat up a business associate on video without warning. This is not about what the Supreme Court decided this summer, though. This is about the authority of the legislature.
They were trying to look at our mind and determine what was the legislative collective intent of the legislature.
That's bill sponsor Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley. He disagrees with the Florida Supreme Court's recent decision that prosecutors shouldn't have to prove their case twice.
You're innocent until proven guilty. This bill applies this fundamental tenet of criminal law to the self-defense immunity hearing. Unfortunately, the Florida Supreme Court in its recent decision in Bretherick v. State misinterpreted legislative intent. In fact, the Bretherick decision was classic overreach, the kind of judicial overreach that conservatives such as myself find objectionable. Therefore, it's no surprise that Justices Kennedy and Polston, the two conservatives on the court, agree with the logic in this bill.
The bill also has the backing of the NRA, trial lawyers, public defenders, and families against mandatory minimums. It's opposed by state attorneys who agree with the high court. They say the bill also leaves a lot of open questions and could result in another rewrite of the law. But Bradley believes in the merits of his bill.
If a state is unable to convince a judge that there is sufficient evidence that an individual is guilty of a crime, then that there is not sufficient evidence to convict someone at trial. So I reject the idea out of hand that this bill would result in otherwise guilty individuals going free.
Meanwhile, as a father of three teenagers, Bradley says his heart goes out to McBath and her family for the loss of Jordan Davis. After recently passing its first Senate panel, his measure still has two more stops to go before heading to the Senate floor. Meanwhile, its House companion has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
It seems there's more of a connection between Florida and West Virginia than you might think. Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi has signed on to a multi-state lawsuit challenging an Obama administration rule that requires reduced carbon emissions from power plants. The lawsuit filed today in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia is spearheaded by West Virginia and includes two dozen states. It alleges that the Environmental Protection Agency overstepped its legal authority in approving the rule, which is aimed, at least in part, at addressing climate change. West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey's office said the rule would require costly compliance measures or closure for coal-fired power plants. The Clean Power Plan is one of the most far-reaching energy regulations in this nation's history, Morrissey said in a prepared statement. West Virginia is proud to be leading the charge against this administration's blatant and unprecedented attack on coal. Still to come on Capitol Report, FAMU students are cheering after board chair Rufus Montgomery resigned the position in the wake of a failed bid to fire the school's president.
And I think that all the negative press that FAMU has been getting is because of him specifically.
A growing number of Florida pain patients are finding street heroin is easier to come by than the prescription pills they used to take.
So if you can imagine, what we're doing is creating a program where they can get that needle to be able to wean themselves off of it and prevent the further transmission of HIV.
And a Confederate general represents Florida in Washington, D.C.'s Statuary Hall. But some are hoping to change that.
I think that in the last 90 years, since General Kirby was nominated by our state, we've had some significant folks.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by CGI, a partner to government and industry delivering built-for-government information technology solutions for nearly 40 years. CGI, committed to providing IT results Florida can count on. Details on the web at cgi.com.
Florida A&M University's board chair has resigned his position a day after backing efforts to fire the school's president. Len Hatter reports Rufus Montgomery has been one of President Elmira Mangum's harshest critics.
The FAMU board's attempt to fire Mangum during a Thursday emergency meeting once again put the animosity between the president and now former board chairman Rufus Montgomery on display. Montgomery's comments toward the president were curt.
Are there any members who have not spoken to the motion who wish to speak at this time?
This is Elmira. I would like to speak at some point, sir.
Dr. Mangum, yes. Are there any, duly noted, Dr. Mangum, are there any members of the board who have not spoken to the motion who wish to speak at this time?
Montgomery and Mangum have clashed publicly almost from the time she started her job in April of last year. It reached a peak during the summer. That led powerful FAMU alums, who are also lawmakers, to call for Montgomery to resign, as Mangum accused him of bullying.
Stand by Mangum! Stand by Mangum! Stand by Mangum! Stand by Mangum!
Two attempts to fire Mangum went nowhere Thursday, but they did fire up students, who marched to the Capitol in protest, demanding Montgomery step down. Among them, FAMU computer science major Aaliyah Barrington. She believes Montgomery has been largely responsible for the discord. And Barrington says she takes it personally because Montgomery is a FAMU alumnus.
When we came to FAMU, it's all about being a FAMU-ly, and he's not displaying the FAMU-liness at all. It's like he didn't learn the cohesiveness of an HBCU or the love that we all share for each other and for our university. And I think it is time for him to go, and I think that all the negative press that FAMU has been getting it's because of him specifically.
The school's governing board has seen a lot of shakeup in the past few months. Several trustees have resigned this year and been replaced. And one, former trustee Marjorie Turnbull, says Montgomery's decision to step down as board chair is a turning point.
Hopefully there will be new leadership that is going to be more engaged with the president, understand that she was brought in here to make significant changes in the way that FAMU managed its financial side of the house. And if she can get support from the board to make those changes, I think there's no stopping FAMU in achieving excellence.
Montgomery remains on the board for now. His term does not expire until January. Still unknown is how the board will move forward. It gave Mangum a poor performance evaluation and recently denied her a bonus. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Moving forward with a priority of Senate President Andy Gardner, a House committee this week unanimously approved a bill that seeks to boost employment of people with disabilities. The bill was approved by the House State Affairs Committee in preparation for the 2016 legislative session that kicks off in January. The bill, in part, would require state agencies to take steps that could lead to more jobs for people with disabilities. As examples, it would require each executive agency to develop a plan for promoting employment opportunities for people with disabilities, and would require the Department of Management Services to develop training programs for human resources officials and agency managers who hire workers. Gardner, an Orlando Republican whose son has Down syndrome, has focused on issues related to people with disabilities. He and House Speaker Steve Crisafulli, Republican of Merritt Island, said during appearances this month they hope to pass a series of bills that would expand educational and economic options for Floridians with disabilities. The Obama administration has a new plan to combat the abuse of heroin and prescription drugs. The president is calling for a shift away from incarceration and towards prevention. Meanwhile, as Kate Payne reports, a Florida Democratic representative is working on a needle exchange program in support of that effort.
According to the Institute of Medicine, about a third of Americans suffer from chronic pain, and a lot of people seek relief for that pain. In 2012, healthcare providers wrote 259 million prescriptions for opioid-based medications. That's one bottle for every adult. But with the increased use came dependency, and then a crackdown on lax prescribing laws. Jason King from the AIDS Healthcare Foundation says this might be why more people are turning to a cheaper high, heroin.
Law enforcement throughout Florida suggests that the state has, you know, been doing a really good job cracking down on pill mills. But the problem is addicts are now turning to other intoxicants, which may explain a significant increase in heroin and methamphetamine use.
There is a strong correlation between injection drug use and preventable infections like HIV and hepatitis C. Scott County, Indiana, experienced this in the spring of 2015 when the rural area became the epicenter of an HIV outbreak. That county's city of Austin, population 4,200, saw 170 new HIV cases in 8 months. Enter Dr. Beth Meyerson, co-director of the Rural Center for AIDS and STD Prevention at Indiana University. Meyerson says the way to prevent these illnesses is through needle exchange programs.
It isn't just about the clean needle, but the clean needle is important, very important. What happens in these programs is that the people and organizations that work in syringe access programming actually provide linkage to testing and to primary health care.
The public health community says decades of research support the efficacy of needle exchange programs. A long-standing ban on the use of federal dollars for these controversial exchanges has slowed their growth. But 35 states and Washington, D.C. have established the programs anyway. Broward County Democratic Representative Katie Edwards is proposing one such program for Miami-Dade County. House Bill 81 would establish a needle exchange pilot program at the University of Miami. The program would be funded by private donations, not state, county, or federal dollars. Edwards says the state should turn towards harm reduction.
It's a one-to-one needle exchange. So if you can imagine, what we're doing is creating a program where they can get that needle to be able to wean themselves off of it and prevent the further transmission of HIV and hepatitis C and other bloodborne illnesses.
Critics don't want to give needles to addicts at the taxpayers' expense, but supporters say they're already paying for treatment. Many users don't have access to private health care, and their bills are picked up by the state. Dr. Hansel Tooks at Miami's Jackson Memorial Hospital says preventing even 10% of these infections could result in a $124 million saving.
My colleagues and I at University of Miami, we were seeing more and more people hospitalized for abscesses and cellulitis. So we wanted to look at the numbers at Jackson and see just how much money we were spending on treating these preventable infections. And we found that it was $11.4 million over 1 year.
Public health officials say needle exchange programs provide more than clean needles. They link users to the public health system. Healthcare workers can establish trust and provide testing, counseling, and addiction treatment. The House Health Quality Subcommittee approved Representative Edwards' plan. Similar bills have been proposed in recent years, but none have been passed into law. For WFSU News, I'm Kate Payne.
Well, Florida lawmakers will continue a special session next week to redraw Senate districts, but visitors to the Capitol might not realize that, at least for three of those days. The House doesn't have any scheduled meetings next week, while the Senate has scheduled floor sessions Tuesday and Wednesday. That according to the chamber's calendars. The Senate's expected to approve a redistricting plan, which will then toss the issue to the House. A meeting of the House Select Committee on Redistricting is scheduled for November 2nd, with House floor sessions slated the following 2 days. You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, in June of this year, nine black men and women were shot and killed at a South Carolina church. As details about the incident and the alleged shooter emerged, it became clear the suspect, Dylan Roof, was motivated by racial hatred. It's likely no consolation to the victims' families or the Charleston community, but the shock of those murders prompted many throughout the South to reassess their relationship with the Confederacy. Now, as Nick Evans reports, a South Florida Republican lawmaker is questioning one of Florida's entries in Washington, D.C.'s Statuary Hall, Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith.
In some places, governments have acted swiftly, usually lowering a Confederate flag that's been flying over public facilities for decades. But in others, hearings have been tense and largely futile.
For what such a small group of what even I consider ignorant people have done with it.
Rural Walton County in North Florida heard heated public comment on both sides of the issue before deciding to switch the Confederate flag flying at its courthouse to an earlier version. But that's not the only place you find Confederate symbols.
I visited Washington, D.C. for the first time in half a decade, and I got a tour of the U.S. Capitol.
This is Representative Jose Diaz, a Republican from Miami. And while he was there, Diaz saw Florida's entries in the National Statuary Hall. Each state submits two illustrious individuals to represent it.
The first I had heard of, which was the inventor of refrigeration. But the second, which was General Kirby, was a little known Confederate general.
Diaz thinks Florida should choose someone else in part because while Kirby Smith was born in St. Augustine, he spent most of his adult life in Tennessee. The Diaz bill would task the Great Floridians Committee with choosing a replacement and the Florida Arts Council with choosing a sculptor. Many Confederate flags went up during the 50s and 60s in response to the burgeoning civil rights movement. But the statue of Edmund Kirby Smith came much earlier. At the turn of the 20th century, there was a similar wave of Confederate nostalgia in the South.
The grand cause, the lost cause, that's the term I was looking for. Yes, they lost the war, but they lost it with nobility. And
That's University of South Florida Professor Emeritus Gary Mormino. Central to lost cause mythology is the downplaying of slavery as a motivation for the Civil War and an emphasis on the honorability of the antebellum South. This eventually brought forth things like the movie Birth of a Nation and the second wave of the Ku Klux Klan. It also brought numerous monuments to Confederate heroes like Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and Nathan Bedford Forrest. But Mormino resists lumping Kirby Smith in next to them.
First of all, he is not the demon many people may hope he is.
Instead, Mormino says Kirby Smith is harder to pin down.
Kirby Smith may seem like an easy target. Here's a Confederate, so therefore let's tear him down. And he turned out to be a much more complicated figure. I had known for years I've used his home, his family's home in St. Augustine, is now the home of the St. Augustine Historical Society Library. It's called the
So I took a visit.
Let me take you out here onto the porch. The building you're in, we're going into right now, was built in the 1880s.
This is Bob Naraki, Chief Librarian for the St. Augustine Historical Society. The The Sagee Smith House may be where Kirby Smith was born, but it's seen significant remodeling since then. And in the small garden out back, they have their own statue of the general.
So when we look at these two statues here, we don't see them as they were, master and slave, but we see them in their final years. You see Smith with his academic robes on as a professor, and you see Darnes with his medical bag.
Darnes was Alexander Darnes, Kirby Smith's slave valet during the Civil War. After the war ended, he went to school, eventually studying to be a doctor at Howard University. When he established his practice in Jacksonville, he was the first African-American physician in the city, and just the second in the state. This statue, made and donated by a direct descendant of Kirby Smith, has come in for some criticism because it seems to downplay the master-slave relationship. But when it comes to the statue in Washington, the question is twofold. Was Edmund Kirby Smith a figure worthy of praise or scorn? And what motivated Florida lawmakers at the turn of the century to propose him for Statuary Hall? The first question is muddy. Senior librarian Charles Tingley says Kirby Smith was torn about entering the Civil War.
So there are letters from Edmund Kirby Smith to his mother living in this house right before secession. And it's things like, I don't know whether I should resign or not. Ask Uncle Putt what he thinks. Uncle Putnam was the Surveyor General of the state of Florida, the man that Putnam County is named for.
But he says Kirby Smith was also very pro-South and was a popular and frequent speaker at Confederate gatherings after the war. When it comes to the legislature's motivation, there's a bit more clarity. Recall, the statue in the Sagee Smith Garden depicts Kirby Smith not as a general, but as an academic.
So we're very proud of the fact that our statues here tell a different story. The statue in the United States Capitol has Edmund Kirby Smith in full dress Confederate uniform. So I think there probably was a political statement being made at the time, but I haven't read the whereases in the enabling legislation.
Looking back through House and Senate journals from that era, there's no smoking gun. But it's clear some were thinking of Kirby Smith's status as the last general to surrender. In 1913, State Representative Robert Hosford explained his vote, saying, although he generally opposed making appropriations for dead men, because Kirby Smith was, quote, the last of our Confederate generals to give up his sword, I feel it my duty to cast my vote to perpetuate his memory. Diaz's bill has garnered one co-sponsor, Tampa Democrat Ed Norain, who sits on the measure's first subcommittee stop. Meanwhile, Lutz Republican John Legge has filed similar legislation in the Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report, and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.